Listen closely. That's not just paint rolling on a wall. It's artistry. A master painter carefully applying Benjamin Moore Regal Select eggshell with deftly executed strokes. The roller, lightly cradled in his hands, applying just the right amount of paint. It's like hearing poetry in motion. Benjamin Moore, see the love.
A new equation for switching on outcomes is here from PwC. It's human-led and tech-powered. It's PwC with Oracle, SAP, Salesforce, and Workday. It's PwC with Microsoft, AWS, and Google. Simplify your systems and amplify your results. Switch on outcomes with PwC and their alliances. Learn more at pwc.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The history of the British Empire in Iraq reads like a morality tale for America's current efforts in Iraq. Cultural ignorance and blinkered ideology set the British goal of modernizing Iraq awry, sending that country on a tumultuous course in the decades that followed. Tonight's guest, historian and Iraq scholar Toby Dodge, says this is history that America must understand or run the risk of repeating tonight on Point, Inventing Iraq, Lessons for America from the British Experience. But first, news from Baghdad on the struggle to establish security in Iraq. The Washington Post reported today that Paul Bremer, U.S. administrator in Iraq, has conditionally decided to support the creation of a new Iraqi paramilitary. The Iraqi Governing Council has lobbied for the creation of an Iraqi force that would search for resistance fighters, gather intelligence, and be given broad powers of detention and interrogation. The new paramilitary would be drawn from the security and intelligence wings of disparate Iraqi political groups, returned exiles, Shiites, Kurds, and Sunnis. Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. I asked him what he thought about such a military paramilitary group being deployed to shore up Iraqi security.
I'm actually fairly open-minded about the idea and probably inclined to support it. There are a number of caveats, obviously, you have to express right away. This force should not become so big that it could be hijacked by part of the governing council and become essentially a militia in a future Iraq civil conflict. It obviously should not be so big that it diverts attention or resources from Iraqi police, and it should not be seen as a competitor with American military forces on the ground. But if all of those cautionary notes are taken into account, I think it actually could make some sense because there are parts of Iraq, notably the southern part of the Sunni Triangle, where many of the general population do not seem very happy with the United States' role in Iraq and don't seem to want to share intelligence with us necessarily, but they're also opposed to the Ba'athists and those who are using violence against the United States. And therefore, if there were a third party, an independent party, that had the ability to chase down leads and act on information, I think some of that information might be more forthcoming from the Iraqi population.
Michael O'Hanlon, what's your sense of how this paramilitary force would actually function? What would its jobs be? Who would it answer to? Who would its sponsors be?
Those are the right questions because there is the ultimate uncertainty about who would answer to, and would the governing council, which would nominally have control over it, really have final control? In some sense, the answer has to be no, because the governing council doesn't even have ultimate final control over its own ability to stay in power. The individuals there are essentially American appointees, and even though we certainly don't have any interest in taking people off the council, in theory could if somebody started fomenting hatred or sectarian violence or what have you. So by the same token, if the governing council started abusing this body, we could find some way to stop that. So I think what you're looking at is a situation where operationally, day to day, the governing council runs the show, but the United States is still back in the wings, watching, making sure that nothing gets too out of hand and that the group is used for the purpose that was intended.
And that purpose is heavy-duty policing, something more than the Iraqi police are doing so far, something between policing and military work?
I think that's right. My understanding is that the idea here would really be to cultivate intelligence sources. I think at some point, if the intelligence were good enough and if these people found a cell of 30 or 50 Ba'athists somewhere, they might very well want to bring in the United States to help them attack that cell. So I'm not sure that their real core purpose is ultimately to use force. I think the main purpose is to gather intelligence and to be safe enough in the process that they don't get attacked or destroyed on their own. They could do some raids perhaps independently of the United States and coalition forces, but my presumption is that if they got good intelligence, they would be tempted to want to share it with us and organize a raid together.
Is this a positive sign or is it a mark of desperation? It hadn't come up before. The U.S. was pointing toward its training of police that's been going on apace and its anticipation of a revived Iraqi military force at some point. Suddenly, this is on the table. Why?
I think there are a number of reasons. Clearly, we would like to have better tactical intelligence than we're getting. It's improved. It's not as bad as sometimes alleged. And when you talk to commanders on the ground or read their comments, you recognize there are a lot of tips that we're getting. But the quality of those tips could be better. And there are certainly some people, for example, 15 of the famous individuals from the deck of cards that we still haven't found, that were really stalemated in finding. We haven't made any progress on the so-called deck of cards in a couple months now. Obviously, Saddam himself is also at large. So there are some real challenges here that we're not able to surmount using existing mechanisms. That's certainly part of it. And in that sense, we are trying to improve a situation that's not as good as we'd like it. But by the same token, I think we also want to let the Governing Council have more authority and come closer to being a sovereign body inside of Iraq because it wants that authority, because it's been pushing for more of a role in creating security forces, and because our strategy is to show the Iraqi people that we are trying to give as much control to the Governing Council and other Iraqis as quickly as we can.
The Washington Post quotes an unnamed U.S. official in the civilian administration. They're saying, essentially, we can't have a process whereby militias are institutionalized here. He says, if that happens, we will not have a unified Iraq at the end of the day. What are the risks associated with new paramilitary forces being put into the Iraqi scene?
Well, let's say that most of these people wind up being Sunni because that's where we're having the greatest trouble and because we need people who are trusted among the Sunni population. So then you've created a militia of 5,000 Sunni soldiers and officers, for example, hypothetically. And then to what extent can that militia, somewhere down the road, be used against other ethnic groups in Iraq? We all know the Sunni Arabs in Iraq are already a little bit nervous as a group about their loss of influence, the likelihood that their voice will not be as strong in the future because they're a relatively modest percent of the overall population, 15 to 20%. Therefore, the perquisites they had under Saddam Hussein, they will not enjoy in a future more democratic Iraq. And to the extent that they have that view and that they've created this militia force that's largely Sunni, it could become the strongest single Iraqi force on the ground in the country. And at some point, it could theoretically be used against other ethnic groups. So that's the sort of thing you have to worry about.
But the governing council leaders, as far as we know, are saying they want these forces to be drawn from the intelligence wings and security apparatus of diverse parties, of the exiles, the Iraqi National Congress, Iraqi National Accord, from Shiite groups and from Kurdish groups. That doesn't sound like a Sunni predominance. Might it be a recipe for internal conflict, civil war?
You're right, and I'm glad you drive home the point of what they're saying, but I think it's still a distinction worth making that the reality may be somewhat different than what they're saying, because to the extent the problem is concentrated in the Sunni regions today, and to the extent, therefore, we want people who are able to get intelligence from that part of Iraq, then there's going to be a natural tendency to want to recruit more Sunnis. I'm just trying to hypothetically consider what could go wrong, and overall, I think it's a good idea, but if you want to ask what could go wrong, this could become predominantly made up of one ethnic group, and then theoretically hijacked by that ethnic group at some future date. I don't think the risks are all that great of this happening. For one thing, the United States military is going to keep tens of thousands of forces in Iraq for the foreseeable future. And by the time we leave, a larger Iraqi army will have been created that is considerably larger than this small constabulary or militia or counterintelligence capability we're now considering. So I don't think the fear is all that great, but that is the sort of thing that could theoretically go wrong if you weren't careful.
And as you say, the Iraqi Governing Council wants to do it, and the U.S. administration there may need to have it. So off we go. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Michael O'Hanlon is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution. He spoke with me from Washington. In the days leading up to the invasion of Iraq, U.S. General Anthony Zinni issued this warning, quote, "If we think there is a fast solution to changing the governance of Iraq, then we don't understand history." His words were prophetic. The current American-led effort in Iraq labors in the shadow of an earlier and failed British attempt at nation-building between 1914 and 1932. Now, decades later, it is America wrestling with growing unrest and uncomfortable realities. Our guest tonight, historian and Iraq scholar Toby Dodge, says that this British history is vital background to understanding America's current efforts and whether they will succeed or repeat Britain's failures. Do you see lessons for America in the British experience in Iraq? Is the American superpower in a position on a course to succeed where the British Empire failed? You can join our conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Washington is Toby Dodge, Senior Research Fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization and Regionalization at the UK's University of Warwick, and an Associate Fellow at the Royal Institute of International Affairs in London. He is author of the new book, Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied. Good evening and welcome, Toby Dodge.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here.
It's wonderful to have you, and thanks very much for your book. It's got eye-openers on every page. I enjoyed it a lot. You have been in Iraq since you did most of the history of this book, I guess, kind of looking over the shoulder of British and U.S. efforts there. Toby Dodge, when you stand in Baghdad in 2003, does it bring back an earlier era of British efforts? Does it bring them to mind?
Oh, very much so. I think, I mean, the thing to stress to an American population worried about the increasing casualties is we've been here very much before. The British secured Iraq in 1917, and within 3 years they faced a country-wide rebellion, looking down the guns of 130,000 armed tribesmen trying to drive them out. This revolt started in June 1920, and it took until February 1921, 2,000 casualties, and then a lot of money, £4 million, to suppress that revolt. Now, I think you could argue that the end of that revolt then gives birth to a series of problems that resulted in the failure of Britain's attempt to build a state. The revolt meant the occupation became extremely unpopular in Britain. The wartime coalition government with Lloyd George as Prime Minister and Winston Churchill in it, was ejected from government in an election campaign fought largely on whether Britain should be in Iraq and what on earth it was doing there.
Remind us, in a nutshell, what took Britain into Iraq in the first place, or to create Iraq in the first place, I guess, more probably.
Certainly. Just after the beginning of the war in 1914, Britain invaded what was then three disparate provinces of the Ottoman Empire. Now, they came up through the Persian Gulf to seize the head of the Gulf, the strategic dominating area there, to stop the Germans or the Turks getting it. And then they moved up to Baghdad, took them until 1917 to seize Baghdad in a very hard campaign. But they were drawn in there for strategic interests in the middle of the war. And at the end of the war, we had the birth of the League of Nations under American President Woodrow Wilson, saying to them, look, you can't hold this ground on imperial terms. If you want to have a part in Iraq's future, you've got to promise in front of the international community to build a liberal, democratic, stable Iraq for Iraqis.
And did London pledge itself to that goal?
Certainly. I think London was very aware that at the end of World War I, it was facing a whole new international situation. It clearly had the empire was at its largest. It held vast new areas of territory. But it was also almost bankrupt. I think the end of the First World War heralded the decline of the British Empire. It knew it was facing, at that time under Woodrow Wilson, a very active America who was very anti-imperial. So it set about trying to create in Iraq a state that would be tied to it, to quote Winston Churchill, through ties of goodwill and common interest.
We'll come back and look at what the substance of that period was, but at the end of it all, you say Britain failed. What was Iraq left with when the British left?
Well, very much so. If we try and think that Paul Bremer today has the same task of trying to build a state. What does building a state mean? It means taking governmental institutions right down to the lowest possible level, to Iraqis spread across the whole country, and building institutions that have meaning for ordinary Iraqis. So if you and I were Iraqis sitting in Basra or Hilla, you know, at the periphery of the Iraqi state, we'd look at what the Iraqi state was doing and say, we appreciate that, we see the value of it, and we'll give it our support. Now, the British didn't do that because they fundamentally misunderstood the dynamics, the nature of Iraqi society.
And the evidence of their failure, as you call it, when it was all over?
The evidence of their failure when it was all over, that the state they bequeathed to the Iraqis couldn't control society, it had no legitimacy, and it increasingly reverted to more and more violence to create a, to control a society that didn't regard it as legitimate or indeed credible.
We're talking tonight with Toby Dodge, author of Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied, about lessons from the British experience in Iraq for America in Iraq today. He says, learn from these lessons or risk repeating them, risk repeating failure. You can join us tonight. Is the United States in a better position to succeed in Iraq today than the British Empire was 80 years ago? And does the American superpower have the resources and the patience to lead Iraq to real democracy? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Toby Dodge, stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about lessons from the British experience in Iraq for America in Iraq today. My guest is Toby Dodge. He joins us from Washington. His new book is Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied. You can join the conversation. What should the U.S. learn from the British experience, the British failure in Iraq? And are you ready to invest the 18 years of effort in Iraq that Britain did? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-8255. Talk. Toby Dodge, I'm just looking at the cover of your book and the photograph here where we have, well, you'll have to describe it to us, but we have a standing looking quite important, but not altogether unified. Clearly some British folks and some Iraqi folks, and a photograph that suggests a political state of affairs. Fill in the picture for us.
Well, the picture was taken at the peace conference in Versailles in France that greeted the end of the First World War. So the great powers and all other interested parties gathered at Versailles to make their case for shaping the world how they saw fit. Now, this fellow at the front is who's to come King Faisal of Iraq, the monarch that ruled Iraq with British quiescence.
With his great robes and the scimitar, or anyway, dagger in his belt and the whole headpiece.
That's right. He came from Hejaz, which is now in modern Saudi Arabia, and he led the Arab revolt, which was the British-inspired revolt in what is now Saudi Arabia, that spread up to what is now Jordan to harry Turkish troops and to keep them pinned down while the British army came to finish the job. Now, next to him is Lawrence of Arabia, T.E. Lawrence, mm-hmm. The great promoter of Faisal and his father. And then next to him is a guy called Nuri Said, who became the strong man in Iraq, the man who enforced order in independence Iraq right up until 1958, when the coup that swept that government from power murdered him in a rather gruesome fashion. So there we have King Faisal, Nuri Said, and Lawrence of Arabia,
all in one.
Figures of colonial Iraq and independent Iraq.
All in one sepia-toned photograph. You're in the States now. You see how the attention that Americans are paying to what's going on in Iraq and how things are unfolding in Iraq. Take us back in time to the point that you will, maybe 1920, but to the British involvement there and the way it began to unfold. Do you see parallels in deployment of troops, in goals, in ideology and attitudes, or are we engaged in something different this time?
I think we should be engaged in something different, but my great fear is that we're probably not. That the great problem with the British is that they didn't sit down and investigate Iraqi society. They didn't really have a very detailed understanding of Iraqi society. So they assumed it was a series of things that they thought, oh, Iraq must look like this. Iraq is an Arab, Muslim, pre-modern country, so therefore it must be run by tribes and tribal sheikhs. So after 1920, after the rebellion, when the occupation was very unpopular, to cut costs, to cut lives, to withdraw the troops very quickly, they started looking for a series of intermediaries, social figures with whom they could give power and whom they could bundle the state to as they fled.
Well, that certainly brings to mind a picture, if I may, Toby Dodge, just on the front page of the Wall Street Journal this morning. You may have seen the story. But it's profiling an American officer, I think a captain, in an Iraqi town who was having all kinds of casualties among his 400 and some U.S. troops under his command until he got in league with a local sheikh, kind of empowered that sheikh and made an alliance and said, we've got to tamp down on this. And he's smiling in the photograph or the illustration on the front of the newspaper and saying, this is working. We finally found the way.
Now, the question is, who is this sheikh? Where does his power come from? And what does this American captain understand about him? Certainly, there's been some notorious cases. The British, indeed, in Basra, in the immediate aftermath of the war in late April, were looking for figures of social influence. In 2003, this is, and a guy called Tamimi knocked on the barrack doors and said, hey, I'm the local sheikh, give me the power. And they were so relieved they did say, hey, look, he's got a robe on, he looks like a sheikh, let's give him some power. Now, they were very perplexed when most of Basra was appalled by this, and they said, this guy isn't a sheikh at all. He's an ex-general in Saddam's army. Get him out of here. He's an imposter. So the danger is that if we don't understand Iraqi society very well, we're going to fall upon characters who claim to have social influence, claim to be authentic, when actually they may not be. And that's the mistake the British made in the 20s, and it may well be the mistake the British and the Americans are making today.
You say that the British essentially fell back on or fell into this strategy in part because the cost in lives and money of the 1920 revolt had made the whole British presence there very unpopular back home, and that from 21 on they were always striving to cut costs cut the cost of their presence there, which made them rely more and more on Iraqis that, in your view, were not the right Iraqis. But yet they were there for many more years. When did Britain give up on the idea of creating what they had hoped to create, or did they ever? Did they think they'd done it when they left?
Well, I don't think they did. Yeah, they actually left in 1932. In the end, the nationalist politicians in Baghdad forced them out. And also, I think there was a recognition in London that that it was time to leave. They couldn't do any more, that they were too constrained by British public opinion. But I think there was no, in those final days in the run-up to 1932, there was no illusion that what they'd set up wasn't what they set out to set up in 1920. It was very shaky. It was very violent. I mean, if you think about what building a state entailed, it would entail at least a generation of lots of money, but also Americans in this case, or British in that case, getting down into Iraqi society, overseeing the growth of all types of institutions, whether they be local government, national government, doing everything that a state does. And in the end, the British just didn't have the stomach for that commitment.
You write about the alliances that they made, which you see as misbegotten, but also about how the British tried to overawe Iraqis with their military power, in particular their air power. I wish you could describe how that was employed.
Sure. I mean, shock and awe was invented in Iraq. Air power, the use of bombing to control people was invented. Coming out of World War One, there was a technological leap which allowed aeroplanes to fly at about 200 feet and drop bombs with a comparative degree of accuracy.
I mean, they would look almost funny to us now, I suppose, the old biplanes and kind of rickety-looking World War One era aeroplanes. But in 1920 in Iraq, it must have been quite a spectacle.
Well, you imagine if you're someone in Iraq living in a rural area, you've never seen a plane before, let alone seen anything more violent than a gun. A plane flies over and drops a bomb right into the middle of your village, which explodes. It was incredibly frightening and extremely effective. So when the British tried to cut costs, they brought in aeroplanes and armored cars. So they'd fly over a village, drop leaflets, say, you have to do these six things or we're going to bomb you. And when those things weren't done, they came back and flattened the villages. It was an immensely powerful tool, but a very blunt instrument that you could bomb a population, make them begrudgingly quiescent, but you couldn't win their hearts and minds, and you couldn't explain to them what they needed to do to get the state up and running.
Ultimately, not effective. Now, at the heart of this, you describe a Britain burdened by ideology that was inappropriate, that wasn't working. And then you come to Washington today, and you paint the different camps there, and you describe them as warring camps within the Bush administration and the ideologies that they represent, what they're trying to pursue. Who do you think is on the right beam here? Is it Colin Powell? Is it Paul Wolfowitz? Where do you see hope in the Bush administration, or the best hope of a strategy and ideology for working in Iraq?
I mean, being in Baghdad in May and June and being in the headquarters of the Coalition Provisional Authority, it was amazing. I mean, building a stable state in Iraq is the core foreign policy goal of the of this administration. But the Provisional Authority in Baghdad was riven with disputes and bad feeling between the factions that we know so well that dominate Washington, between the neoconservatives gathered around the Pentagon and the State Department people. I mean, it was a very unhappy organization.
You described them coming to decisions or trying to, and then getting on the phone back to Washington, and all kinds of new instructions come back from the ideologues at home base.
Exactly. So you've got these two camps. I think we could broadly describe the State Department as the technocratic experts who have some knowledge of the Middle East, have some knowledge of Iraq, and I would assume are quite skeptical about the job that needs to be done. Then we go over to the neoconservatives, Paul Wolfowitz, the personification of them at the Pentagon, who are very ideological. Iraq is no different to anywhere else. If we just sweep aside the bad guys, the Iraqis will do it for us. So on one side you have skepticism and knowledge. On the other hand, on the other side you have ideology and wishful thinking.
But I wasn't entirely sure where you came down, Toby Dodge, because you seem sympathetic to the idea that ultimately if the U.S. wants to bring a more modern government, a democratic government, it's going to have to go in with a kind of root and branch reform, reconstruction of Iraq. That seems in line with the breadth and sweep of Paul Wolfowitz's vision.
Exactly. I think there is something rather seductive about Paul Wolfowitz's vision. It's big picture. It's very detailed. It's very honest, I think. But what worries me about him is he doesn't have the knowledge. He's made a series of statements which show a glaring lack of understanding of Iraq. So although he clearly, I think, is sincere in his wish to build a stable democratic state in Iraq, I don't think he has the detail to direct that with any degree of sense.
So how will you be judging whether the U.S. is going to repeat what you call Britain's failure or whether it's on a new track here? What will you be looking for?
Well, I think what needs to be done, the Americans need to get down into Iraqi society and build the state from the grassroots up. Build, as I said, local government things and put local Iraqis at the head of local government. So if you were an Iraqi sitting in a small Iraqi town, you'd say, I know the guy who's running this local government. He's an Iraqi. I can elect him. I can see on a day-to-day basis that the government is ours and we have power over it. My great fear is that corners are already being cut, that after the ceasefire, the Coalition Provisional Authority held a series of grand conferences in Baghdad. They appointed the interim governing council, which was largely made up of exiles. Now, if you travel around Iraq and you ask Iraqis, hey, what do you think of these guys? They're very, very cynical about them. And the danger is that setting up a grand council in Baghdad has actually alienated the mass majority of Iraqis from the government. So it's had the reverse effect. And by focusing on Baghdad, instead of getting into society, traveling across the whole of Iraq, the Coalition Provisional Authority may well have missed a trick. They may well have created something that's not helping them, may well be hindering them.
Let's turn to our callers. Camp is calling from Milwaukee. Hi, Camp. You're on the air.
Oh, thank you very much. First of all, very good topic. Very good show. It's very, very interesting listening to this. You know, in terms of the failure, however, of the British Empire, or maybe even our own failure, is it always our fault? I mean, maybe it's the other person's fault, too. I mean, just like if somebody flunks out of Harvard, is it really Harvard's fault?
So you're saying Iraq has its own challenges here and its problem and its own blame if things don't go well.
Well, sooner or later, they're going to have to step up to the plate. I mean, they're going to have to do it. They're going to have to take over. They're going to want to be what they want to be. And really, up until now, it's just been totally tribal. So maybe they won't it tribal. Maybe it'll be tribal in 5,000 years.
Camp, we've got it. And Toby Dodge, there's a lot to respond to in that. I mean, you know, the central idea, look, let them do it. But you hear the observation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, I certainly agree with the sentiment that there's two sides to this responsibility. Firstly, British Prime Minister Tony Blair and President Bush made a series of promises in the run-up to the war to the Iraqi people. They promised to leave them a stable democratic state. They promised to be there as long as it takes.
So, and no one put a gun to their – no one forced them to make those promises. I mean, those were made
exactly,
in
and they made those promises
will.
in sincerity to give the Iraqis what they'd been lacking lasting for so long.
But
so
you point out in the book that wasn't, those promises were not made just out of the goodness of their heart, that it fit into a big strategic picture.
Surely, no one's there for charity. They saw the regime of Saddam Hussein as a direct threat to their interests for a series of reasons. But in rallying support for the war, they still did make these promises. And I think the Iraqis are just in asking for those promises to be delivered. But to take up Camp's point, on the other side, there is an Iraqi responsibility, but the question, as always, is which Iraqis? Which Iraqis should we give power to? Which Iraqis should we help to run the country? And I think that question may be being answered incorrectly in Baghdad at the moment.
You suggest reaching way down in a way that sounds awfully challenging, past almost every what you call local influential, at least the people who had any kind of power and prominence under Saddam Hussein. You describe reaching way down into kind of mid-level bureaucrats, teachers, I don't know, good folks who were not empowered before and lifting them up. That sounds like a big job.
It's certainly a big job. And let no one be under any illusions. This is a 10, 15-year project. And whether American troops, British troops, or indeed the international community and the United Nations are going to have to be in Iraq for a long time. And I think that commitment comes out of the promises made at the beginning of the war.
Will is calling from Windsor, Wisconsin. Hi, Will. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. Good topic.
Sure.
I think the U.S. will come out as Britain did of not doing what they thought they could do. And number one is because they didn't understand what would happen after the fighting stopped in Iraq. I'm a Vietnam veteran. I'm used to guerrilla warfare, and that's exactly what I see. And I don't see where the United States is gaining that number of people that it need to support them in order to win this. I strike a parallel between Vietnam and Iraq when I say that I don't feel that this country will stomach the casualties nor the financial burden that it will cause. And that's by the way we went into Iraq, by an administration that, if not really lying, slanted the truth. And as people began to see the facts of what the intelligence was, and they see the bodies coming back, and you can see it now because many families of those troops are speaking out,
yes,
that this country will lose the stomach for it, and we're asking for the troops to come home.
Will, let me have Toby Dodge pick that up before the break, and thank you for your call. How about the issue? And take us back for a history lesson again, Toby Dodge, to the British experience. Did the British population begin to lose heart over Iraq? At what point? And what were the consequences of that as they faced their own guerrilla war?
1920 was the point when the British population looked at, weary with war, wanting to see tax cuts, didn't want to see further expenditure on international adventures. They looked at Iraq and asked the question, what on earth are we doing here? Why are British troops, 2,000 British casualties, in a country that doesn't want us? And then the British public opinion mobilized, voted out the coalition government, threw Lloyd George, the wartime prime minister, and Winston Churchill out on the basis that they thought they were overstretching, that they were jingoistic and too ambitious in what they wanted Britain to do. Picking up on Will's point about not understanding, I think that's an extremely important point, that in the run-up to the war in 2003, there was a lot of over-optimistic things being said and almost no planning for post-war scenarios.
We'll come back and look at that. We're talking tonight with Toby Dodge about lessons from the British experience in Iraq, lessons for America in Iraq today. You can join us tonight. Is the United States in a better position to succeed in Iraq today than the British Empire was 80 years ago? Do you resonate with Colin Powell's limited political ambitions for Iraq or with Paul Wolfowitz's vision of sweeping change? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about lessons from the British experience in Iraq for America in Iraq today. My guest is Toby Dodge. His new book is Inventing Iraq, The Failure of Nation Building and a History Denied. You can join the conversation. If Washington ultimately punts and leaves behind a perhaps more friendly authoritarian state, is that, to you, a failure? And if the U.S. effort in Iraq falls back to the Afghan model, where U.S. troops work with local warlords, where does that lead? Will the U.S. go the distance in Iraq? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan is calling from Framingham, Massachusetts. Hi, Susan. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is there anything to be learned from the current experience in Afghanistan for Iraq? And is there actually anything going on between these two countries as far as discussions? They're kind of both going through similar experiences.
And what angle of Afghanistan catches your attention for potential lessons, Susan?
Well, I remember the Loyal Jirga meeting.
The big pre-constitutional convention.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if that was similar to the setup in Iraq, or it strikes me as rather different, that okay. It was more of an internal.
Let us take a look. Susan, thanks for your call. Toby Dodge, what do you see going on in Afghanistan and the U.S. approach there, and how it's similar or different to Iraq, implications for that approach in Iraq?
Sure. I think there are a series of differences which make the comparison, although very interesting, very difficult. Afghanistan is a mass majority rural country that hasn't seen much development. Iraq, on the other hand, is 80% urban, with many years history of a modern infrastructure, schools, development. So you have two very powerfully different countries. Now, also, I think that there's a radically different attitude in America's policy towards Afghanistan and Iraq. If we look at, say, Bob Woodward's book, Bush at War, President Bush was very keen for American troops not to get drawn into nation building in Afghanistan, stated it again and again, I won't have my troops building a nation in Afghanistan. And so American troop deployments are very limited. They're primarily search and destroy, find Al-Qaeda, find Osama bin Laden. And the joke about Mohammad Karzai is he's simply the mayor of Kabul, that his power doesn't spread beyond that. Now, I think when we look at Iraq, President Bush seems to have made a conscious and a much broader, much more courageous decision to be in there for much more longer time, high numbers of troops, wider spread, much more ambitious attempt to build a state there. I think on the other side, what we want to desperately avoid is what's happened in Afghanistan, that the law and order vacuum has re-empowered warlords across the country who have almost total autonomy to do what they want, and what they're doing is deploying violence for corruption and for their own ends. So if there is any lessons from Afghanistan, it is, if you're going to be serious about nation building, you've got to deploy an awful lot of money, an awful lot of time and expertise.
Imran's calling from Ashland, Massachusetts. Hi, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi. I wanted to get back to, maybe a point that was made earlier, and that was the choice of advisors that the administration used in coming up with policy. And I think one example would be the use of Bernard Lewis as kind of like the historical guide or guidance towards
guide
Iraq.
To the region, guide to the culture.
Yeah, and I remember reading that there was a lot of kind of dissatisfaction because I think that he tended to stereotype certain aspects of Arab culture that, you know, they only respect the exhibition of power, and if you don't hit them with a big stick, they don't really fall in line. And then and similarly, I guess the choice of people like Ahmed Chalabi, this kind of relates back to the other point that your guest made, where there's some sheikh who's smiling with some American, and the question is, did we really know who we were getting into bed with at the time?
Who you're really standing with. Let us pick it up, Imran, and thanks for the call. Toby Dodge, what about, first of all, sources of inspiration or illumination that you see the United States following as their kind of beacons here, and secondly, the local alliances made so far?
Sure. I mean, we don't actually know what Bernard Lewis said to President Bush after 9/11 and in the run-up to the invasion of Iraq. But looking at Lewis's work, I mean, Lewis is a very fine and august historian, but has never done much work on Iraq itself. So, I mean, if President Bush was looking to Bernard Lewis to advise him on Iraq, he was certainly looking to the wrong man. I think the bigger issue certainly is the role of the Iraqi National Congress and its president, Ahmed Shalabi, a very powerful, very charismatic figure in Washington, and clearly, and you can understand why, wanting America to invade. And so there were a series of policy prescriptions Ahmed Shalabi laid out in Congress and to the administration. Invade and you'll be welcomed as conquering heroes. Invade and you can take over the country relatively easy. I have a network of followers in the country that will help you. Now, as we know, the American forces did invade, and sadly, they weren't welcomed as conquering heroes. And Ahmed Shalabi's network, we're still waiting to see Ahmed Shalabi's network. Certainly, when I was there in May and June, the president of the Iraqi National Congress was an extremely unpopular figure amongst ordinary Iraqis. They saw him as an opportunist and almost an American stooge, and his accrual of power under the interim governing council was extremely unpopular. So to pick up on Imran's point, I think there is a worry that the people that the administration was looking to advise them may well not have been well-versed in Iraq and in Iraqi society.
Toby Dodge, take us back to the British history and its handover to Iraqis. Describe for us, if you will, the aftermath of the British departure from Iraq. What did they leave behind? What happened with it? And what are the lines you draw between their failed effort and the consequences for Iraqi history?
Certainly. Because the British misunderstood Iraqi society and didn't build a stable state, they left a governing elite that was very small, no more than 200 or 300 people, and didn't have much influence in Iraqi society. So what the governing elite had to depend on was an army. They had to deploy increasing amounts of violence to keep their seat, as it were, on this rather tempestuous situation. Now, that meant that Iraq, sadly, was not only the first country to gain independence under the League of Nations, it was the first Arab state to have a military coup, that the military very quickly took center stage, and they thought, well, if we're keeping this government in power through the deployment of violence, then we'll just take the power ourselves. And there was a series of coups all the way through to 1958, when the big coup came and the remnants of the British, the regime the British left, were swept from power. A very bloody takeover, and then again another series of violent coups, and one military regime after the other tried to solidify its power, and finally in 1968 the Ba'ath Party took control, and Saddam Hussein's forces with a degree of unheard of brutality and oil wealth managed to cement their grip on power that lasted through to 2003.
And the rest we know. So what's your advice? In a nutshell, how can this be done?
I think it has to be done. It has to be done properly. I don't think the U.S. hasn't got the troop numbers. It clearly hasn't got the expertise, and it hasn't got the money to do it. This has to be internationalized. The United Nations have to be brought in. Now, Iraq has the second largest oil reserves in the world. It also sits between the Gulf and the populous areas of the wider Middle East. Just imagine the instability if the violence in Iraq continues to spread, if the Islamic radicals of Al-Qaeda are drawn in to fight the Americans in Iraq. I think that the great powers in the Security Council in New York need to realize that this needs to be multilateralized. They need to come on board, but also President Bush and his administration need to know they need to be brought on board as equals, that they need a share of the managing of Iraq and the rebuilding of the state.
And why does that make it better? You point at Somalia, Cambodia, other examples where the UN was involved, and they certainly didn't become paradise.
No, certainly they didn't, Somalia especially, but I think it's clear that the occupation of Iraq needs to be generation-long. Just spending a few days in America, there seems to be a great worry, understandably, about the levels of losses, and as your caller Will, a Vietnam vet, pointed to, there may not be the political commitment amongst the wider population in America for what's going to be a very long haul, so we'll need to look elsewhere for troops, money, and expertise, and the UN, sadly, is the only organization that can do that.
And maybe with that, escape the shadow of the British legacy there. Toby Dodge, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Toby Dodge, senior research fellow at the Center for the Study of Globalization and Regionalization at the University of Warwick, author of Inventing Iraq, the Failure of Nation Building in a History Denied. You can continue this conversation online at onpointradio.org. Click on forums. In a moment, singing the praises of marathoner P. Diddy Combs. This is On Point. Hip-hop mogul Sean P. Diddy Combs was named Athlete of the Week by USA Track and Field yesterday for successfully completing the New York City Marathon. P. Diddy ran the 26.2 miles in a respectable 4 hours, 14 minutes, and 54 seconds, and in the process raised more than $2 million for charities in the New York City's public schools. Massachusetts English teacher Michael Obel Omea knows Combs has never exactly been a model citizen, but in this radio diary he shares his hope that P. Diddy's marathon will start a new trend among hip-hop artists.
Given the kind of attention that P. Diddy has garnered lately, the trumped-up sweatshop allegations, his highly publicized gun trial, and a general malaise that constantly surrounds the hip-hop world, one might suspect that he ran the New York City Marathon for the publicity. The nature of his business, creating a persona that carelessly takes from society and circumvents laws with impunity while collecting baubles, vanquishing enemies, and seducing beautiful women with insouciance, seems to demand that he selfishly serve himself. But P. Diddy didn't run the marathon for the publicity. He used it to raise over $2 million for good causes. I applaud P. Diddy for his vision, his commitment, his perseverance, and his feat. As he himself responded to critics who questioned his motives, 26 miles isn't a publicity stunt. Hip-hop has enjoyed increasing commercial success for the past quarter century as it evolved from a marginal urban music form to a central entertainment conglomerate that dictates American language and fashion. Its presence and influence are so pervasive that 3 weeks ago, Billboard's top 10 songs were all hip-hop R&B songs for the first time ever. P. Diddy has had a great hand in the proliferation of the music and its attendant fashion and language. Unfortunately, hip-hop in general has failed to grow in any substantial way, save in its superficial influences on culture. At its best, hip-hop expresses the joy and the pain, the hope and the hopelessness, the hype and the reality of a people traditionally voiceless and powerless in society. As a fan of hip-hop, I love its immediacy, its rawness, and its power. Artists such as Grandmaster Flash, KRS-One, and Public Enemy entertained, made money, and educated. But these artists have given way to performers whose sole priority is to make money. P. Diddy has been one of the most influential in creating this new, glossier, self-indulged hip-hop that kneels at the altar of excess and neglects its responsibility to entertain and educate. Hip-hop de-evolved, returning to its party roots and abandoning its social conscience. How often have you heard about a hip-hop artist doing something for someone other than himself or herself? Rarely. That's why I'm so heartened by P. Diddy's commitment to something other than his impressive empire. In 4 long, hard hours, Sean Combs made an altruistic gesture that might inspire other artists in the business to do something for others rather than to talk incessantly about themselves and their morally bankrupt existences. P. Diddy's commitment to training might also inspire the legions of obese children addicted to his music and self-indulgent lifestyle to do something other than listen and dream about a life that serves only itself. If he keeps sharing his treasure, time, and talent, then others may join him. Because of its influence, hip-hop can play a vital role in shaping the nation's direction. Already, Democratic presidential candidates Howard Dean, John Kerry, Richard Gephardt, and Al Sharpton have visited hip-hop godfather Russell Simmons and asked his opinion on how to reach that important demographic. P. Diddy, with his run, may have shed a spotlight on this year's newest and hippest demographic. Move over, soccer moms. and share the stage with hip-hop homeboys.
Let me tell you something. Yeah. Sometimes I rhyme slow, sometimes I rhyme quick. I was on 125 in St. Nick.
Michael Obelomia teaches English at the Roxbury Latin School in Boston. He lives in Needham, Massachusetts. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Six figures and camcorders. So what you trying to tell me, dear? I got Bentley, Benz, and Mr. Belvedere. And I just want to blow your mind. I'm talking literally blow your mind. My repertoire is menage a trois and exotic.